If there was ever a time to consider switching to making your coffee at home instead of picking up on your way to work, now is the time. And now, more than ever, you can make better coffee at home anyway, especially when you start with Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that they deliver this fantastic coffee to your home or office inside Canada or the United States within 1 week of custom roasting it, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. It's completely flexible and customized. No commitment, just convenience, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. When you get started, enter the promo code TOP100PROJECT for a 20% discount. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hello, you cooties covered kids, and thanks from the Far East to the North American Midwest for downloading the Next 189 Project. This 7+ years effort to talk about every movie ever made started when we had a more specific goal of yammering about the 123 classics that comprise the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. We finished that up a long time ago, so now we just highlight flicks that tickle our interest, and we spoil. I'm the guy who touches his face way more than 3,000 times a day, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who would offer her jacket to a dying guy who's got the chills, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Little do we know, she's about to die herself. That's her last scene, Kate Winslet, until she's in a body bag. Very stark moment, one of many in this film, which is Contagion. And we're doing this because, of course, we're experiencing this exact problem in the world right now. We record this on March the 12th.
Yeah, today's the 12th. And so a lot happened today.
And who knows where things will be by the time we post this on March 30th.
But just for context, today is the day that they delayed the NHL season.
The NBA. Suspended them.
And then the NCAA maybe is going to be canceled. I think they were talking about closing Disneyland and Disney World. In Ontario here, schools are going to be closed for 3 weeks starting on Monday.
And baseball has been at least delayed.
It's been a big day.
I'm a-getting it. And people are buying toilet paper by the truckload. Okay, then, so fun podcast about to happen here. The coming attractions trivia for Contagion. And it's our first Steven Soderbergh film. Soderbergh and Matt Damon have worked together 8 times, one of which was a TV movie, Behind the Candelabra, which I don't know why didn't make it onto the big screen. Michael Douglas, Matt Damon, Liberace. Anyway, TV movie there. Of those 8, what's the highest ranked on Rotten Tomatoes? Which was the biggest box office hit, and which is your personal favorite?
Rotten Tomatoes prefers Behind the Candelabra, has 95% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Contagion of his theatrical films, incidentally. But yes, Candelabra, number
one. Yeah, Contagion isn't that far behind. Highest grossing was Ocean's 12.
I got Ocean's 11. This is harder to find. Fucking box office mojo, man.
Oh, I just had wrong numbers then. I can't remember where I looked it up. I think it was just on some Wikipedia page, and I arranged it by box office.
Let's just say one of the Ocean's films then.
Sure.
I had 11, you had 12.
And speaking of the Ocean's films, this was hard for me to pick my favorite. It was between Contagion, The Informant, and what I just have to say is my favorite. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I really loved it so much when it came out, but that's Ocean's 11.
Ocean's 11 is the most fun that Damon and Soderbergh have been together. Maybe the most fun Soderbergh's been in any case, with or without Damon. And it's certainly way up there for me, too. Maybe number 2, but I got to go with The Informant, which we just watched again maybe 3-4 months ago.
It's aging well. It's a great movie.
One of Damon's great character performances and so many really subtle touches in that. He's a great liar. The voiceover, one of the better voiceovers of modern history. Damon has a great one in Rounders, too.
And it's all a true story. And I knew what was going to happen because I had listened to the This American Life episode that it was based on. Well, they're not the ones that did the journalism, but at any rate, I knew the story when I went into it, and it's all true, and it is just hysterical, and the twists and turns, and just the baffling humanity of it all.
One of the great touches, Soderbergh almost always has something in his movies you can take away from it, a different thing that he does that other people don't. And that one, he cast a lot of comedians in supporting parts. And some pretty big name people. I don't think I knew Joel McHale at that point. I think Patton Oswalt's in that. I don't know if I knew who he was. Well, I guess I knew he was the voice of Ratatouille. I should say the rat.
Remy.
Remy. Right.
How am I remembering the rat's name?
Ratatouille's the food. Yeah. Anyway, so the eight collaborations are Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. Che, part two. Damon's in that, I think, briefly. The Informant, Contagion. And then he has a very small scene, but a very important one and a good one in Unsane from a couple years ago. Soderbergh did that with Claire Foy. Okay. Ew, Germs was released by Warner Brothers and other production companies on September 9th, 2011. It wasn't a big hit here, but was a solid success worldwide. And lately on Netflix, if you could measure this box office-wise, would be a monster hit because people have been watching this movie for the past 2 months, including me twice because I saw it at work and then you said, we should do this for the podcast. Didn't really want to bump the other movies we had in the next couple weeks, but I thought, well, we could just not take a week off for Easter. So we won't, and we pushed a couple movies ahead, and instead we're doing this one at the end of March. But please, Bev, remind everyone what this movie's about. With the Contagion, Skinny.
Meet Beth Emhoff, but don't get too attached. Beth is patient zero for a brand new, mysterious, and terrifying virus that is quickly spreading around the world, killing roughly one quarter of the people who get infected, regardless of their age or health. Throughout the crisis, we watch scientists and bureaucrats work very hard to treat the sick, protect the healthy, despite budget strain, a panicking public, deliberate misinformation, and the disease itself, which is swift and merciless.
Or, in a nutshell, fake flus.
Oh.
Fake flus.
If there's one thing...
I was looking forward to a laugh from that one.
No, it's not even funny. It's too true. I'm sorry. I wouldn't call this a flaw of the film at all, but it's almost like they too neatly dispose of the single villain who's spreading misinformation. And I know they kind of allude to other people spreading his message as well, but they really seem to pretend that it's just this one small contained problem of people spreading misinformation and encouraging, I'm using scare quotes, alternative treatments.
Now in reality, it's the president doing that.
Yeah, and implying that the government is lying to people and truly being responsible for people's lives ending by being so irresponsible as this guy is. But it's good that they include a character like this because it's very important to acknowledge this very ugly part of humanity. But I almost feel like they undersold it.
Well, he's Alex Jones before Alex Jones had the pulpit he does now. I don't know if Alex Jones was on. Well, maybe he was on the scene in 2011. I never heard his name until maybe 5-6 years ago, if even that long ago. But he reminds me a lot of that kind of person. And then he benefits financially because his followers get him out of jail. Now, maybe he's going to just get bail and eventually actually have to go to jail when they convict him if they do. But for the time being, when the movie's over, he's able to roam free because his rabid followers bail him out.
It also seems like a fantasy that he would be arrested for his actions because people every day, everywhere get away with this and worse.
They probably weren't back in 2011.
I guess you're
right.
Our
world's changed that much in that long. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 85% of critics like this film. 224 fresh, 41 rotten, for an average of 7 out of 10. When I first looked at this, would have been 4 days ago, 5 days ago, the reviews were 215, I think, fresh. So something like 9 reviews have gone up. That's how many people are watching this movie. I'd rather the podcast be dated by the time we actually post it than not be dated.
It won't be.
But it probably won't be. And 63% of audiences. So barely a fresh tomato with them, but a big time thumb up from the critics with the 85%. It was 45th at the 2011 U.S. box office. Matt Damon's We Bought a Zoo with Cameron Crowe made $34,000 less. Can you believe that? Back-to-back movies from the same guy and not even $1 million or $2 million apart, but $34,000 apart. And in retrospect, this almost seems like the more commercial film. For one thing, it got an IMAX release, which is unusual for a Soderbergh film, not the big superhero or Pixar kind of thing you'd expect. Even then, you would have gotten that. But speaking of big films, Harry Potter Part 97, whatever it is, The Deathly Hallows Part 2, was the big box office hit of 2011. I think we saw that together. One of our, not first movies, I guess, but I believe we saw that with some friends of ours, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, well then, we just saw this a few days ago. Like I said, a nice curveball from what we were going to do in a more meaningful movie than maybe anything else we'll cover for a long time. What are your thoughts on Contagion?
Contagion is great. It's just so mercilessly effective as an epidemic film. I still have this visceral memory of watching it in a crowded theater and feeling this great animosity towards the one poor dude with a cough in that theater. It's incredibly watchable. It has this really great unstoppable forward momentum. And it leaves you almost surprised when the credits roll because it genuinely leaves you wanting more. And that's also saying a lot for a film that unceremoniously kills two of Hollywood's biggest movie stars at the time. And of course, this year, it has gone from being a very good procedural about a fictional epidemic to an absolutely essential film that does the impossible and entertains us while responsibly conveying information about how we ought to proceed when faced with this challenge.
Almost feels like a documentary now. And you mentioned the two big stars. Well, that's Gwyneth Paltrow and Kate Winslet, who get killed off. Gwyneth Paltrow has a very memorable death in a movie we've covered before. That would be...
Oh, God.
Seven! We don't see it, but we know she gets her head cut off. I saw the head in the box, David Fincher! No, you didn't. But this time we do see her head in one of the more memorable, I would say, meme-worthy looks on anyone's face in acting history when she's about to expire in that emergency room. Wow.
Also, we see her head undergoing an autopsy. Mm-hmm. You see her in close-up with that terrible death mask face and being cut open with her scalp being pressed over her face. There's something very gruesome about this, but it's not cruel. It's realistic and it's necessary, you know, by doing an autopsy in her body. They're starting the very hard work towards saving a lot of people from suffering her fate.
Yeah, the boss of the two coroners says, I want you to step back from the table. I don't know how he knows how serious it is, but he realizes right away when he looks into that brain, maybe 20 seconds in, oh God, this is way more serious than we thought it was.
Because the virus attacks the brain, and that's why she dies of a seizure. And I think everybody who does die of the disease dies of a seizure, correct?
They die pretty fast, too. She seems like she outlived some of them, although you can't show all the deaths at the same time unless you have a big box on the screen with maybe eight faces. But we see her death, I think, after we see a lot of the people from China, because she came in contact with them. That's really well done. Some of it in flashback, including how we actually find out what really happened with this contracting from animals to humans at the very end of the film. And we'll get back to that in a second. So they do have MEV1. That's the name of the disease. I wonder if that's supposed to be some kind of joke. I bet the filmmakers have something where maybe it's motherfucker, everyone, virgin, I don't know.
Virus.
Virus, yeah. I guess the V is probably for virus. But that's what they call it, MEV1. The experts said about the film itself that it doesn't skimp on science. I guess they got the facts mostly right. No movie ever gets the facts entirely right. Even documentaries often will get the facts sometimes very wrong, no matter how hard they try, because you are making a dramatic entertainment. And as you just said, this movie is surprisingly entertaining, and it is surprisingly fast, too. It probably should be nominated for the editing, because it zips along very quickly. I feel like we just saw Gwyneth Paltrow dying, and it's already over.
That's what I'm saying. It goes by in a flash. And it's 50% montages. There are parts of the film where it almost feels like you're watching those old music videos. The song would be montage and then they would break for a scene. Some kind of drama would happen, carry through the plot that happens in the music video. But then back to the music video, montage, montage. Because the montage, in a way, is the star. And maybe that's because the real main character of this film is the virus. It's not any of the people that we see that we barely get attached to. It's incredible that the film can be as engaging as it is when there isn't any real emotional in.
And Soderbergh cast a lot of big name actors in this too. People like Matt Damon and Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Winslet, Jude Law, Lawrence Fishburne, even Marion Cotillard, who'd won an Oscar by that point. Bryan Cranston, of course, a TV star more so. Ton of great character actors, but some big names are in this movie. And you're right, it's not any one actor's on screen more than anyone else. It's probably Fishburne's movie in a way more than anyone else, because he is the head of the CDC. And Damon maybe arguably has the most screen time.
Damon is also our cipher.
The everyman.
Yeah, he's the one that we can relate to.
The schlubby everyman, especially for Matt Damon. Your sister loves this guy.
That's her crush.
Well, she'd really have him quite on the same pinnacle when she sees him in this film, because he's looking pretty average and ordinary, especially for Matt Damon.
He looks very dad. This is Matt Damon at peak dad. And there's plenty of roles where he plays peak dad. There's just something about him that has that vibe where you can automatically believe him in that role.
He's not the glamorous one in the Ocean's films with Soderbergh either.
Mm-mm.
Of the big name guys.
Certainly not in The Informant. He's even schlubbier
in
The Informant.
Yeah, and in The Oceans, he's the dork of all of them. He's not the appealing, sexy guy.
Something that I love about him being our entrance to the film, in many ways, he is the very stereotypical Hollywood cipher for everybody, because he's a straight white dad. But
with all his hair.
With all
the world's his oyster.
Exactly.
Sky's the limit.
But they aren't the typical Hollywood family. In many films, It would have been all about him trying to protect his family and doing everything that he has to do, and of course, succeeding in the end. Very few films would have done what this film does, which is kill Gwyneth Paltrow. Literally 5 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes
in. And then kill her son minutes later.
Kill this adorable child immediately after. That goes so far to make the audience terrified of the villain of the story, which is the virus, and to really drive home the randomness, the cruelty of a sickness like this. I also love that he's a part of a blended family. That's his stepson, not his son. They make that really clear. And that his wife was cheating on him. This little detail that they don't need to add in there, but that makes it feel that much more realistic. When I think of the family that I'm describing, the Hollywood family, I think about Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds. Somebody who has to save his family. By saving his family, he saves his family because they were having troubles, but then he proves that he can be a good dad and then they're all together at the end. That's not what this film does at all. What it does is it presents something that's so believable and realistic and down to earth that it feels that much scarier and real. We know that guy, you know what I mean?
There have been movies made about the dalliance, and that's the storyline. She was over in China, and then she flies back home to the Midwest because the Emhoffs live in Minnesota. But then she stops over in Chicago deliberately to have a little relation with her ex. They make that, maybe not clear, but it's mentioned at one point that John Neal, and Steven Soderbergh is the voice of John Neal, incidentally, in the beginning of the film. We only hear him on the phone, then you see him later on. That's not Soderbergh, that's just some other actor. But when he talks on the phone at the beginning, that's Soderbergh. Beth was with him before Beth and Mitch got married. And at the end of the movie, when he's got the prom thing for his daughter going on, he's upstairs finding her camera and finally cries. And I think he's crying because his wife died, but also it's more of the matter of, now I can actually think about the fact that, yeah, she was cheating on me and with somebody she was with before. There's a whole layer to this movie that goes beyond the actual real storyline with the Emhoffs. We've seen that movie many times. We don't need to see that again. But that's one of the better things about it, I guess, is the depth of what's going on with Matt Damon's character and the Paltrow character, for that matter, too.
It does what so many of the best scripts do, which is that it really gives its characters a past life. You really feel like they existed before the movie started. I read that last moment at the end differently, as if, like,
that happens to us a lot.
Who cares? Yeah, it's true. Who cares that she cheated on him? He just misses his wife. He's having this tender moment with his daughter. And how can you have that emotional
connection
with your
daughter? I read that, too. I'm just saying there's another layer to it.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I'm seeing the evidence of her trip, although John Neal was here in the States, not over in China. But I'm seeing evidence of this trip, and it ended with her cheating on me. And then that also spread the disease even further because he was in Chicago, and then we see his body being wheeled out of, well, he's not dead yet, but he's being wheeled out of his house. So Beth, completely inadvertently, has spread this even further because of that. If she had not cheated with him, which is bad enough, but she's also made the disease go even further by doing that. Well, the first thing the whole film we hear, while the credits are still playing at the beginning, we see all the vanity credits, is Beth coughing. And of course, that's the old Chekhov thing. If somebody coughs in the first act, they have to die in the last act, but then she dies within 5 or 10 minutes. But she coughs, then we see her eating peanuts from a bowl where everyone shares. So of course, people are going to do that, and they're going to get the virus that way. And she hands her credit card to the waitress, then the waitress gets it. And we see later on that she blows on dice for some high roller in this casino, so he gets it. And a young woman sees the best phone is still sitting on the bar. Here's your phone. And she gets it.
Signs her death warrant.
And we actually see all of them die before we see how they got the connection with Beth.
Yeah, it's such a cool touch because you see their faces in one way or another. And then later on in the film, you get to find out how they caught it from her.
Another reason why the editing was probably worthy of at least a nomination at the Oscars.
And Soderbergh treats this with such a deft touch. He leaves the camera lingering on these surfaces, the credit card, the poker chips, for just an extra second. We never need the movie to say it out loud. He's safely assuming that we already know exactly what kind of movie we signed up to watch. And he doesn't waste time explaining how pathogens work, which is refreshing. Because again, we get it. There's some concepts in this film that they do explain to us very carefully through exposition. But as far as a sick person touches peanuts and then the next person who eats one of those peanuts gets sick, it's all right. We can figure it out. And then the film opens with this montage of all the people, the sick people, going from place to place, touching doorknobs, subway handrails, and of course, spreading the disease far and wide. An image that is on front of all of our minds right now as we are the ones on the subway or at a bar with peanuts.
Yeah, but the coronavirus isn't as serious or as contagious and isn't as much of a problem as what's in this movie. Or Outbreak. There's a lot of movies that have been about this kind of thing where that one's airborne in Outbreak. That's the problem because you don't want to be around somebody at all. If somebody has coronavirus and is near you on a subway, you probably don't know they have it. But if they just sit beside you, and people will, people have, but you don't need to freak out. You're not going to get it automatically by being beside them. But disease movies, most of the time, it's more dramatic, I guess, and more thrilling if it's airborne. So if you're anywhere near them, man, you're probably dead. I was reading a little bit about this in the trivia, though, that a disease that's this efficient at killing you can't be this contagious because it would kill itself off too fast.
Part of the problem with COVID-19 is that it takes so many days for people to present symptoms that it makes it very contagious because it will walk around with it, where that wasn't necessarily true with SARS, I think, and Ebola is like you describe, it kills its patients too fast to really be that contagious. The most efficient at spreading is measles. When they talk about the R-naught number of a disease, measles has 15. 15 people will get sick for every patient, because that is airborne.
We've talked already about Damon being really good in this movie in an everyman kind of way, but he's also, I guess you can't say dumb. He just can't accept the fact that this is true. I've rarely, if ever, seen a scene play like this in a movie before or a TV show where a person is told that their better half or anyone in their family has died. Okay, but can I see her?
Okay, you know what I read in that
scene? He can't accept it. That's what it is.
He can't accept it, of course. But how often have you heard they died on the table, but then we resuscitated them? I can see how he thinks, how is it possible that his
that doctor's bedside manner is not the best either.
No.
He doesn't do the whole sort of, okay, Mr. Emhoff. He's a little bit too much of like a scientist rather than a doctor, because a lot of doctors are probably not the greatest at delivering bad news anyway, but he really isn't. And I guess that's probably why Soderbergh had him play it that way, so that Mitch would be confused thinking, okay, this is all bad news, but when can I see her?
I think we as a society were quite privileged and lucky. We simply cannot imagine that someone who's young, or she's youngish and healthy, there's nothing wrong with her, that she could die of what seemed to be the flu.
In a couple of days, too.
In a couple of days, yeah. She gets sick, but it is just really hard for us to wrap our heads around the fact that we are that frail. We've gotten very spoiled by the idea that we just don't tend to really be that besotten with life-threatening illnesses. So he's like, my wife can't be dead. She'll be fine. I'm worried about her, but she's going to recover. I can totally understand where that cognitive dissonance is coming from, because if a doctor tried to tell me that you were dead in that sudden manner like that, I'd be like, people like Ryan don't die. He's 46 years old. He's in great health. This doesn't make any sense. It's impossible. He can't be dead. I can see where that would come from.
It's just an unusual way of placing like that. And that's one reason I thought it really stood out in a great way. And it's a bit of a laugh. There's not a lot of laughs in this movie, but it's a little funny when he says, okay, but can I see her? Also, it's made funny. Very clear. Oh, it's a little funny with this, I think. Very gallows humor-ish, though. A lot of gallows humor and stuff we're going to watch next little while and have seen recently, I would say, too. A lot of stuff like that in Parasite. And also, it's made pretty clear early on that he's immune. For whatever reason, he can't catch MEV1. We don't know if his daughter can, but she wasn't around Clark or Beth. So she couldn't have gotten it from them. She could get it from someone else. But then Mitch does his best to keep her away from other people. And that's one of the running themes of the whole film. Now, Kate Winslet, one of my favorite actresses of all time. We've covered her in Titanic and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and she's got a pretty important role in this movie, kind of a middle sequence, though. She's not really in the beginning, and she's certainly not in the end because she's long since dead. But she's the one that tells us the average person touches their face 2,000 to 3,000 times a day. And I joked earlier, I do it a lot more than that. I've always been a face toucher, and of course you're hearing lately a lot about how we're not supposed to touch our face under the circumstances.
We're all coming to terms with just how much we actually love touching our faces. You don't realize until you try to stop yourself from doing it that, God damn, I love touching my face.
I was at work when this was really getting bigger a week or so ago. Again, I feel so dated with this, probably going to sound so ridiculous to say. It was a little bit bad at the time.
I know, things are changing really fast.
But anyway, when I was at work, it wasn't that bad, but they were talking about the whole, how do you handle this? You wash your hands, you don't touch your face. And in that moment, I had an itch one side of my face, and then itch behind my ear, and then itch another side of my face. And I just went ahead and did those things. And I wasn't that self-conscious because I'm thinking, I always do this kind of thing. And I'm not trying to be one of those people who says, I won't get it. But I'm not as worried about it because I'm not 80 years old or my dad, your mom, who are susceptible to death if they get this kind of deal. Older people are those who already got some kind of respiratory problems that have to worry more than we do. But yes, when you hear that stat, you think that's absurd. But then they talk about how many times you do in a given minute. And I guess that maybe includes things like eating. If you're eating a food that's with your hands rather than a fork.
Popcorn or something.
I guess that would, there you go, popcorn. We had popcorn last night. Yep. We went to the movies. I had a ton of it.
Our hands touched inside the popcorn bag.
Right. And as far as the doctors go, Lawrence Fishburne, Kate Winslet, Marion Cotillard, and I think really the unsung hero of the whole cast here. We've seen her in a lot of movies, and she's been good in a lot of them. Jennifer Ely, and she was in Zero Dark Thirty, which we covered a couple years ago, and also The King's Speech, the Oscar winner in 2010. But she's the one that injects herself with what she thinks is a vaccine. This might work. Who knows? And then goes to see her sick dad and feels like if he doesn't make me sick, then I guess I'm okay. And she's speeding up the trials. Now, that is not a good idea for a lot of reasons because she's such an important part of the process to try to fix this problem. She's a very big MVP in the doctor field. But that made me think of this point, which is that, and this could have been a nutshell, I guess, a lot of these doctors, all of them, I guess, the ones we see in the film, are superheroes without capes.
Oh, yeah.
And especially Ali Hextall, because she's risking killing herself. But it also saved a lot of people because she did speed up the trials and made this vaccine usable a lot faster than it would have been if they had gone through the proper channels.
Yeah, this movie's like a Valentine to all of the thankless, boring heroes of the world who just put their heads down and do their jobs and keep us safe every day. They do it right now in all these ways that we don't even realize. I get a little frustrated with this film that's almost radically honest and realistic and then just touches like her vaccinating herself and testing it. That felt unrealistic and irresponsible of her. She's a person who's portrayed as incredibly responsible and almost boring to a fault in how straightforwardly she does her job. And then for her to put her own life at risk when she's probably our greatest hope for finding a vaccine for the disease, it's a little irresponsible. It's also super irresponsible of Ellis to not...
These fucking Ellis's.
To give the vaccine instead to the caretaker's son.
He lets guilt override common sense.
Listen, I understand the temptation to want to save a child.
John Hawks overhears
him. If he wants to save a lot more children, he should keep himself safe and healthy.
Yeah.
Even if you're going to say, okay, give it to the son. It's terrible to say this, but he should be giving his fiance, well, his wife's vaccine to that kid and then the second vaccine to himself and letting her go without a vaccine and just stay in quarantine. Because he has to leave his house so that he can do his job, so that he can save more people. That actually really bothered me because the custodian is giving him a hard time. And of course, the custodian caught him giving a warning to his girlfriend, which then set off a panic. There were actual real consequences to that.
There will be an instant investigation of this.
He could very well lose his position.
He and Cranston have to talk to
His career
government.
Could be very seriously damaged, and rightfully so, because his actions, which were selfish, did start a little panic in Chicago that they were trying to avoid. It's right, as terrible as it is, to leave people at risk in Chicago because more people are going to be at risk if everybody starts freaking out.
You know why it's okay, though? He saves Sanaa Lathan.
Oh, I know. She is. He's fine, but she's Sanaa Lathan. So the idea that she's with him, not like he's nobody, but it's not like he's a super wealthy movie star or something. I'm not really quite sure how he ended up with this epic babe.
In the credits, she's listed as Aubrey Cheever. And of course, his name is Ellis Cheever. So it does suggest they're married. But I was looking at Wikipedia earlier today and it says about how it is, like you just said, his fiance.
They get married so that she can get the vaccine. So they're already engaged.
There's no big party, though, obviously.
No, they just have like a city hall wedding or however they did it so that she would be considered legally his family and that he would be able to give her a vaccine because of his privileged position.
So he does have some ethics issues. But then again, he helped, was a big part of helping save maybe the whole world. But it's funny, though, that he does let John Hawks, the custodian, guilt him. We all got family, doctor. Yeah, but sorry, your kid doesn't matter at all compared to somebody who's the head of the CDC or a big part of this.
Nor he matters more than Sanaa Lathan, in fairness.
The kid?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, I'm just saying the doctors in this movie really do come across as heroes who are so selfless. Kate Winslet dies because she gets her hands dirty with all these people. And like I point out in the intro, she's offering her, she tries to, I don't think he even notices. We don't ever see what happens, but she tries to offer her coat to the guy beside her who's freezing. But she's too weak to push the coat really to him or throw it to him or even say, hey, buddy, you want this? I'm okay right now. Because the very next shot, I believe, is her face in a body bag. She's a superhero, and obviously Jennifer Ely is, and to a big degree so is Elliot Gould, who worked with Soderbergh on the Ocean's films in a completely goofy way, but here he's a completely serious character, just like Dimitri Martin, who was known for his stand-up comedy stuff and The Daily Show. No laughs. If there's any laughs in the movie, it's like I said, the whole moment of, can I see my wife who's dead already?
Oh my God, I can't believe you find that funny.
There's a very dark, morbid laugh in there, I think. Jude Law maybe is a little bit funny, but he's mostly just a slime ball. Now, he's your crush if Kate Winslet's mine in this movie, or maybe even Sanaa Lathan, then I guess Jude Law's always going to be yours.
Well, they put him in some pretty whack outfits in this movie, and they also gave him like a full-blown snaggle tooth. Did you notice that? He has a prosthetic tooth. to uglify him.
Plus, his character's such an ass.
Oh, yeah.
And then he and Paltrow and Damon were in The Talented Mr. Ripley together, where he's at his physical best, probably, in 1999.
Whew, that movie's pretty much pornography.
And those three actors really don't share any screen time together in this movie. Damon and Paltrow very briefly, but Law's never on screen with Damon or Paltrow. I don't think Law ever worked with Soderbergh again either. I'm not sure Fishburne ever did. I can't think of an example. If he did, it was a smaller role. Soderbergh works so often, it's hard to keep track of these kinds of things. Yeah, you know, Damon and Clooney and those guys work with them all the time and multiple roles beyond the Ocean's films, like we already talked about with Damon. But Soderbergh makes basically one film a year since 89. So what is that? 30 plus years. He's made about 30 some odd movies. And this is a guy who's going to give up making movies. He's one of those people like Sean Penn and Anthony Hopkins. I'm done. I'm going to quit. I'm not going to make movies anymore. But he kept on going. That was, I think, maybe 5-6 years ago. And he's averaged about a movie a year even since then.
Is he also his own cinematographer and editor?
Ever since Traffic, he's been his own cinematographer.
He must work around
the clock. He's also the operator of the camera.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember seeing something about that.
He's not just lighting it and framing it, but he's also the one who's actually right there and able to say to the actor, no, do this thing. We'll do another take and do this thing there. He's not his own editor, though. Maybe he has edited some of his films, but generally he's used, more often than not, Stephen Mirion, who cut Traffic and won the Oscar for that, and he cut this movie too. Mirion also worked on Birdman. I know that's not supposed to be a movie with edits in it, but there were, because they were subliminal and digital.
I think I thought of that, though, because Soderbergh started his career as an editor. I always feel like his films, they're very well edited. Out of sight, whenever people ask me, because I'm an editor, what I think the best example of great editing is, I always say Out of Sight is my favorite edited movie.
And you know who cut that film?
I don't.
Ann V. Coates, legend from Lawrence of Arabia.
Legend, yes. Oh, wow. God, I forgot that. And I should know that if I keep telling everybody that's my favorite edited film. Anyway, he's a great editor. His films always set an excellent pace. And this is obviously no exception, because as we keep saying over and over again, it moves at lightning speed, so much so that you don't want it to be over. And it has a conclusion. I would say that it reaches a nice conclusion that you can at least feel safe in knowing what's probably going to happen from here on in. There's plenty of details that they leave out. They could have covered all kinds of aspects, notably, and I think about this now because of what we're going through with COVID, but nothing in the movie talks about the economic impact of everything that they have to do to stem the path of the virus, or even just the economic impact of so many people getting sick and dying. And it seems to be a really large part of the conversation now. Who knows? There's lots of reasons why Soderbergh could have chosen to left it out. First and foremost, that he just had to pick and choose what he wanted to cover, and maybe that just wasn't the thing that interested him. Or maybe he just didn't want to focus on something that could be a distraction from what should matter, which is saving lives.
He doesn't really focus too much on the Armageddon kind of elements of this. If you let something like this get out, the news of what's really going on, and I get why the authorities don't always tell us the information, because people probably would panic. We don't see that much in this movie. We see the scene in the pharmacy where they say we're going to cut it off at whatever, and it was the Forsythia thing. That wasn't even the actual cure. And they trash the place. And we also see somebody go into Damon's neighbor's place and you hear gunshots. Damon witnesses that. He doesn't see what happens, but he can guess what happens. And he goes over later on and then tries to find out what happens. And it's almost like a Shrek kind of moment. One of my favorite laughs in Shrek, which I think is a funny movie, is when Fiona is singing and gets really high pitched and there's birds singing with her. And then she reaches a higher note and they explode. And she has a sort of guilty look on her face when she sees the eggs that have been left behind because she's killed the parents. What's so funny, though, is the next cut is her cooking the eggs.
Oh, yeah.
Because the moment could be, oh, she's really sympathizing with these babies. What are they going to do without parents? But instead, she's cooking the eggs. And Damon was probably going over to see if his neighbors are okay, you could argue. But in a way, I guess maybe he was going over there to... We didn't really loot anything, did he? He seems like he just took the gun.
Well, he just certainly didn't miss an opportunity.
So it wasn't a comedy moment, but it could have been played the same kind of way as Shrek was, which is, oh, opportunity, rather than, are my neighbors okay?
How many movies and TV shows have taken this very same concept and turned it all into the story about how humanity acts under these extreme dire circumstances? They all get guns and they all kill each other and they all fight over resources. Virtually every zombie film devolves into this situation where it's really just humanity fighting to survive, but fighting each other. And it's nice and refreshing to me, and it feels almost radical that Contagion, while they illustrate this ugly side of
garbage
humanity,
on the street,
or like you said, the riots at the pharmacy, certainly Jude Law's character, but they don't dwell on that. As a matter of fact, the real driving force of the story are the people who are trying to do good.
Coming back to the doctors who are trying to do good, Lawrence Fishburne, I think, has one of his better characters, certainly one of his more underrated characters, and the way it's played, and probably the way it's written, too, by Scott Z. Well, we're Canadian, so Scott Z. Burns. Scott Burns. Who actually wrote Bourne Ultimatum, one of the guys who wrote that. Damon Film, of course. The Informant, Damon Film and Soderbergh. And he directed The Report last year. So maybe it's a combination of Burns and Fishburne, and, of course, Soderbergh. But I really like the way that Cheever, so Fishburne, doesn't forget to ask about and care for the human being. When he's on the phone with Winslet, probably a little past the midway point of the film, but not long before she dies, she's been working around the clock, and he says to her, "How are you?" "Well, I'm doing this, I'm doing that." "No, how are you? When was the last time you had some real food?" So he's trying to say, look, you have to work around the clock, and so do I, but you still are a person. You still have to get some sleep. You still have to get some food in your system. I don't know if he's really supposed to know her personally that well, but he's being a good boss, being a good executive of her. Now, he doesn't really deal with Marion Cotillard, but she's got an awful lot of humanity, too, because when she finds out that those people that kidnapped her, maybe she has Stockholm Syndrome, I guess, but she finds out they got a placebo. It isn't very clear. Wikipedia says she does. I feel like it's more open-ended, but she seems like she's going to go back to her captors.
Where else could she possibly be going? She runs away from the airport. She's about to go home. And they're like, here's the real vaccine. And then she finds out that they gave them the fake one. We see her interacting with children in this village that has kept her hostage because they want to get their hands on the vaccine first.
But she is kidnapped, and that's an interesting touch, too. This movie finds all kinds of interesting ways to play off things we've seen. Like you said, in zombie movies, over and over and over again, something goes wrong. The Simpsons have parodied this kind of thing. Something goes wrong in the world, and right away, people go apeshit.
It's 0 to 60 Mad Max.
Yeah, and they're trying to steal from each other and kill each other instantly. But in this movie, it's more a matter of she's still a human being and she's still a doctor. She still cares about these people, even if she was kidnapped. So there's some complexity there, too, which is great.
Another case of somebody who refuses on principle to take the vaccine. Lady, take the fucking vaccine and then go tell them. You can't help anybody if you're dead.
Reminds me of the whole thing in the airplane. They always tell you if you have to put on the mask that falls from the ceiling.
Yes.
Put it on your own face before you worry about somebody who needs help, including your own kid, because you're no good to them if you're passed out and they need the help.
Yeah, this movie ignores that. Maybe to amplify the heroism of our heroes, who are these underplayed heroes. So they had to write in something of them acting really unselfishly so that it wasn't ambiguous to the audience.
Now, one thing that Cheever does when he gives the vaccine to the kid, John Hawks' kid, is he talks about how a handshake is the way you would show back in the old days you weren't carrying a weapon. But in this kind of movie, contact is the weapon.
Get out of here with that handshake.
I'm sure that's what they're going for. Soderbergh and Burns know very well that's the point. Now, the kid, I guess, is okay. He just had the vaccine, but I guess it's implying that Cheever didn't, because he goes in the car and he puts the little bracelet thing on himself. He tells John Hawks, oh, I'll do mine back with my wife. But he doesn't have one to do back with his wife, so I guess he's not going to be vaccinated.
So irresponsible. He wears that bracelet, which is going to give him access to places that he shouldn't have access to.
Maybe the subtext is that this is not over because of that. He's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to be a good person, but he may make it bad all over again.
The last time he tried to do the right thing and be a good person to help his fiance, he caused a panic in Chicago. This man is dangerous. He needs to be stopped.
The real villain, not the disease, is Ellis Cheever. But some great touches in there, because the whole thing about shaking hands, that seems to be going by the wayside now with coronavirus. Maybe we won't keep shaking hands in the future, because it does seem like a really antiquated, dumb tradition.
I remember maybe during H1N1 they tried to talk us out of shaking hands and everybody was just like, that's so dorky, forget about it. But I'm embracing the elbow bump. I'll do it. I don't feel
dorky
about it.
Or don't touch each other at all.
Or just don't. Yeah, that's really what's happening.
Kerry Washington, just yesterday, and again, we record this weeks before it goes up, but she said something about how the fist bump, man, got to do the fist bump from this point on. And I'm reading that thinking, if you're that terrified of germs, then why are you touching anybody at all?
I used to do comedy with this guy who had this amazing joke about the fist bump. You don't shake hands, you fist bump. Take that, germs. What are you going to do? Get to the knuckle? Nice try.
You'll never figure out knuckle technology.
Oh, no. You stop the germs at the knuckle. No.
So at the end, we do actually see how this whole thing went down. This is just dumb luck, though, too. But it is our own making. And I'm sure this is intentional, that we see a bulldozer clear-cutting trees. So bats get forced out of where they were. But they take, one of them at least, takes a piece of banana, ends up in a barn, happens to drop the banana. A pig eats that. That transferred the virus somehow. That got to be a problem. A chef digs inside of a pig, And here we go. This could have been the nutshell, too. Wash your fucking hands before you shake someone's hand when you're a cook anyway, let alone when you're dealing with something he didn't know. Of course, he didn't know that he was dealing with something that was going to be a world killer. But wash your hands before you go shake some VIP, whatever Gwyneth Paltrow's character was, in the first place.
I don't need a virus to convince me to be paranoid about cross-contamination when I'm dealing with raw meat. Isn't that ingrained in all of our heads? My hand touches raw chicken or raw beef. I can't touch anything until I wash my hands. I'm obsessive about washing cutting boards and knives, anything that touched that. And I am not a germaphobe.
And this is before coronavirus.
Yes, just my whole life, because I'm afraid of E. coli or salmonella, which I've had salmonella poisoning, and I'm telling you, that will make you want to wash your hands.
Digging your hands in a pig, they're just gooey and cruddy anyway.
I guess if you're a cook, you probably get pretty used to that pretty fast. But as a cook, you should be habitually washing your hands all the time.
At least before you come out and say hello to somebody.
Yes.
It would take you a minute, not even a minute. Okay, we talked about Soderbergh and Burns, who worked well together, of course, on The Informant, which, as I've said, is my favorite combination between these two guys. By the way, when I say that, Informant, Ocean's 11, Ocean's 11 is the most rewatchable Soderbergh film. Well, that was also, I said, the Damon and Soderbergh combination. My favorite Soderbergh film, period, is probably Out of Sight, I guess.
Out of Sight's way up there.
Sex Lies, we talked about doing last year.
Still love Sex Lies.
And Traffic, we still might do this year, which is one of the great drug films of all time. The producers, Michael Shamberg, Stacey Shear, they both worked on Pulp Fiction with Tarantino long ago, and Gregory Jacobs, who's done a ton of films with Soderbergh. This movie was shot all over the world. I joked earlier about how it went from the Far East to the Midwest of America, but look online at the filming locations, and there's a lot of them. We've seen a ton of movies that are supposed to be in many places, and it might go to three. Not to throw shade at them. Good on the filmmakers to make a movie look like it's in 20 locations or even 5 locations, but really it was 1 or 2 or whatever it might be. This movie really did go to a lot of these actual places. And it is not a giant budgeted movie.
It pays off in verisimilitude. As you said, it feels almost like a documentary.
So it's 185-1. We watch it on Netflix, and it's probably going to be there for a long time to come. I always have to warn people it might not be on Netflix anymore or YouTube or what have you, but I think Netflix will keep this one on for a long time. We said Soderbergh shot it. He's always billed as Peter Andrews. We mentioned the editor, Stephen Mirion, already, who works a lot with Soderbergh, and also George Clooney. I think he's cut all of Clooney's films because, of course, Clooney and Soderbergh have been friends and had that production company, Section 8, for a long time. I think they dissolved it ever since, but that's probably how Mirioni met Clooney in the first place, was through Soderbergh. And the music, we haven't talked about this yet at all. Soderbergh on the Traffic commentary pronounced it Cliff Martinez, so Martinez, but he said Martinez, so I'll go with Martinez. So he did the music for Traffic and also Drive, which is not a Soderbergh film. But he always works well with Soderbergh. And I would say not just the editing for this movie, but the music were worthy of nominations because it's a very unusual and memorable music score.
And the movie relies so heavily on montages. And the music doesn't really get in its own way. It blends in to the background and it doesn't feel like it's its own beast. I don't want to say you ignore it, but it doesn't stand out very much. And it just is this driving force, this almost electronic sound to it, and it goes so far towards creating that sense of urgency.
This movie is, in some ways, a horror film.
Agreed.
And this is more realistic than Jason Voorhees or The Alien or a 25-foot shark that won't give up trying to kill you. Well, maybe that one's actually more realistic in some ways than the other things. But a disease is the thing I've always felt like. This leads me into the what happens next. We discover a more resilient disease. It mutates, goes airborne, and does kill us all. That's what happens next.
Downer.
Well, it's what could really happen in the end. But you said about how the music is not really in your face. I would say it is more so than you're saying, and you're the one that doesn't like big, loud music. But with horror films, you always cut that slack, and so do I.
It's not emotionally manipulative music. That's what I hate.
But this is a horror film of sorts, so it would be appropriate if it was big and loud. We already talked about some of the other virus movies. Well, there's a movie called Virus. Of course, I Am Legend, which I just happened to watch a few days ago again, which is 2/3 of a great movie. But then again, I was about halfway through and I remembered, oh, right, the ending that they changed. I went back and you can watch the theatrical or the director's cut version. So I went back and I went to the part where there isn't this big explosion sequence at the end. I still love I Am Legend anyway, beyond any of that stuff at the end that people have criticized. 28 Days Later is a virus movie. In some ways, I guess the various zombie movies are too, but that's never made clear. Night of the Living Dead, it seems to be, they don't explain it, but it seems to be there's some kind of satellite. The Andromeda Strain, of course, is a virus film, one of the more famous ones. And Outbreak, which is 25 years old this year. And that is a disease that gets airborne and people die pretty damn fast in that little encampment. And just like this movie is filled with either burgeoning stars, because Kevin Spacey's in that movie before he was truly a star. And Dustin Hoffman, Morgan Freeman, a lot of other big actors are in that. And Outbreak is not one of my favorite films, but it's got a lot in common with Contagion. Of the ones I just mentioned, I guess 28 Days Later and I Am Legend are movies I like more. But Outbreak's got some great stuff in it, too.
All these movies take place after the virus has already run roughshod over society. But Outbreak is the other movie other than Contagion that is really about the spread and the attempted containment of the disease.
And in both cases, the good guys win. Humanity wins. We'll see if that happens in reality.
Well, yay. I don't think COVID could do this much damage because the death rate is much, much, much lower than MEV1.
And if we get it, we're probably not going to die. It's just about passing it on to people that are more susceptible to death than we are. Okay, last thoughts on the very fun and super awesome, thrilling, but very real Contagion.
Well, I just have to mention something that didn't really come up, which is that when we were watching the film, there was at least three separate times when I got validly choked up. Watching this movie for the second time, it hit me in an emotional spot that it didn't the first time. When you get under the layer of the procedural aspect of it, there are these really beautiful performances and these really authentic moments that hit you where you feel it. That's probably what makes this movie so enduring and probably what will make it our go-to film about a contagion.
It has been the last couple of months anyway.
Yeah, it seems to have beat Outbreak for the default disease movie.
Dustin Hoffman as an action hero. Unusual choice. No real action heroes in this movie except for those doctors who are superheroes without capes. Okay, solid film and gets better the more you see it. I liked it even more this third time than I did the first or the second time.
And it says a lot that it's holding up so well now that we're actually in the middle of a pandemic.
Yay. All right, if we're all still here in 7 days, we'll continue on the harsh path of people dying brutally as we wag our lips about Robert Rodriguez's Sin City. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Sin City. When Bruce Willis was on Inside the Actors Studio in October 2001, the late James Lipton, and sorry to hear he died recently, said that Bruno does not die very often in his movies. Malarkey, I say! He dies more than most movie stars. So name at least 6 times Brucey met that big yippee-ki-yay in the sky up to the point he was on the Actors Studio in October 2001. Because maybe there's been more since, but just up until October 2001, how many times did Bruce Willis die on the big screen?
Okay, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Sin City. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes of the Top 100 Project are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in either Canada or the U.S., please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
And it's probably best to go to Sparkplug the next little while because it's probably a little safer than going to Starbucks or one of the other coffee
shops.
And
I did check with them and they assured me that they will be delivering through this entire crisis. There's nothing about this that seems to put a stop at all. So by all means, take advantage of this situation to finally try it.
Okay, well, cue up the U2 and let's get this two-person prom started. When
I'll cry, tears, tears, tears.
Is to hear you say cut. Cut, 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 cut,
cut.